Strangest feeling I'm feeling, but your love we will always believe in. Though you may think my faith is in vain, till Shiloh we chant Rastafari's name.
My name is Aronde Ash. I am back with the Ubuntu People's Podcast. The word that we're going to repeat in the next couple of minutes with my guest, Ms. Reese Palmer. The word is detour. Detour. The pandemic and life took me someplace else and I haven't had a chance to have conversations with folks on the Ubuntu People's Podcast. But I'm very, very glad that my first foray back in, probably in over a year, is with... Introduce yourself, ma'am.
My name is Reese Palmer. I'm a singer-songwriter and host of Color Me Country Radio on Apple Music Country. I'm kind of a do-it-yourself musicologist, I guess.
We're going to get into that. And folks, don't adjust your screen. That is a black woman singing country. They exist.
Blackity black.
And we're going to get into that, get into what Ms. Palmer is doing now, talking about the history of black folks in country music, past, mm-hmm. present, and hopefully continuing into the future. Recently, you performed, you said, at the Grand Ole Opry for the first time in 13 years, and you chose three songs to perform. And as an artist, I know there's a specific reason mm-hmm. that you had that platform and chose to perform the three songs. One song was Somerville, the next song was Seeds, and then the third song was a song by Miss Linda Martell, who was one of the first black folks in country to get charted. Why those three songs?
Yes, it was my first time in 13 years. A lot of growth and change has happened in those 13 years.
That's my mom, Donnie, and that's my grandmother, and that's actually Reese, the baby. She was just born.
The artist that I was the very first time I stepped onto that stage is not the artist that I am now. Just in case I never get invited again. I wanted to make sure that I said and I made this particular statement to those particular people in this particular moment. Somerville is about the small town that my mother is from, Somerville, Georgia, which is in between Chattanooga and Atlanta. I used to spend my summers in Georgia when I was a kid. I split the time between my maternal grandmother, my paternal grandmother, and my maternal great-grandmother. And she lived in Somerville. And so we would spend like 2 to 3 weeks with my great-grandma in the house that my mother was born in. It was extremely formative for me that time. And I have extreme fond memories. I have pictures all over my office from being at my great-grandmother's house because it's one of my favorite places to be. Got to eat all the ice cream I wanted to eat. And it's where I got to sing. My aunts and uncles would trickle in and out of my great-grandmother's house and pay me, give me quarters to sing The Greatest Love of All or sing whatever song was happening at the time. And like little four-year-old, five-year-old me was like, yes, this is nice.
I get a little cash for this. I can do this.
Yes, I can do this. You know, also the radio station in Somerville, because it was such a small town, it played country, it played pop, it played gospel, it played R&B, it played all the things. And my family, that's what we listen to, just all of those things. So none of it seems strange to me. I wanted to get on that stage and I wanted to talk about my past, my present, and the reason why I'm here. And so that's what the three songs symbolize. And that's what I said when I walked out on stage.
We met probably less than a month ago, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Our daughters go to the same preschool. We had an initial conversation and you go, yeah, I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and I'm a country music singer. And there's this cognitive dissonance in my ear and in my head. Country music, St. Louis City. Country music, St. Louis City. Again, so you're growing up in this amalgam of sounds from your grandparents and your great-grandparents. But why does country music become the vehicle for your self-expression in the St. Louis area? And this would be early 90s.
I think the thing that stood out to me about country music that just differentiated for me, I loved, first of all, the way it sounded. I liked a lot of the early records, like especially like 70s country, I really liked.
Give us some examples. And who?
I was very into Dolly Parton. But I don't know very many people that don't like Dolly Parton. Like, she's incredible. And I was one of those kids that would read the liner notes or read, like, the inserts.
Oh, please tell people, you're speaking Greek to an entire audience.
I know.
Of
like, they're like, what liner are these notes?
Liner notes? What does that mean, liner notes? What is that?
Well, children, once upon a time, there were things called records. And records were, like, these beautiful pieces of art. And they had pictures and there was graphics and all that before we called them that. And you open them up and on the inside, it tells you who wrote everything. Sometimes it has lyrics and it gives you all the personnel for each song. So you know who played guitar, who played bass, whatever. So I used to sit and read those because I was always curious about who wrote this. Like, where did this song come from?
And then I realized that she was writing all this. And I was just like, wow, this woman is writing all these songs. It's incredible. And at the same time, I was also falling in love with Chaka Khan. And I was falling in love with James Taylor and Phoebe Snow. Like, my mom loved Phoebe Snow. And also, like, hearkening back to the past, my mom was very much into Patsy Cline. I was getting all these different sounds and all these different things. And the things that I loved were just these really great stories set to music. And it was really simple production. It wasn't like overwrought or anything. It was a lot of times it was just a guitar and maybe some bass and like some atmospheric things, but just really simple. And it was just the story, the voice, and that's it. That's what I fell in love with.
With me, you had it made in the shade, but you walked right out on your way.
I can remember like from a very early age, like around our kids' age, walking around with a Play School
tape recorder, the little brown tape recorder
that you stuck the cassettes in. And my dad got me for Christmas, like this full thing of cassettes. And I can remember walking around and just filling it up with songs and song ideas. And I'd be sitting and coloring and then all of a sudden I'd stop and like sing my little line into it and then move on what I was doing.
I guess I just associated, I was like, okay, well, these are the people, these are the artists that are making these sounds.
These are the artists that are using these instruments that I like. These are the artists that are writing these really great stories. And so this is what I want to do. This is what I'd like to do.
And as I got older,
you know, you become more aware of color and race and all that kind of stuff and like kind of where you fit in.
And I'm realizing that I don't see a lot of Black people in these videos. I don't see any Black artists.
With the exception of like Charlie Pride. And at that point I had never heard of Linda Martell, so I didn't know.
Yeah, you're only seeing Charlie Pride. And so I'm like, okay, well, so there's only one Black artist that's doing this. Okay, so maybe this isn't what Black people do. So like I'd be listening to country. I'd be listening to Trisha Yearwood at Faith Hill and Shania Twain in the car. But as soon as I pull up the spool,
then I switch my CD disc changer to like Ja Rule or something, just so the other kids didn't know that that's what I was listening to.
It wasn't until I came into contact with who
became my first managers. They were two Black women
from St. Louis. And they'd actually only worked with hip hop artists before me. So I met them through a friend at school,
in high school.
And they came to my house to meet me and to meet my family. And, you know, I was telling them, I want to be Mariah Carey. I want to be Lauryn Hill. And they were like, okay, that's great.
When I graduated high school in 99, the summer before I went to college, I went to New York with them to do a demo.
And while we were in New York and we're cutting this R&B demo, I had my little notebook that I've always been writing songs in. And they asked me, they're like, what are you always writing in this book? And I was like, oh, these are my songs. And so they're like, sing us one of your songs. And so I sang them this song. And it was a country song. And it was a song I was writing for Reba McEntire. And 17-year-old me. And they're like, that's a country song. And I said, yeah, I know. And they're like, you listen to country? Like, you like country music? And I said, I do. I said, I actually really like it a lot. And they're like, well, why didn't you tell us that when we sat down to talk to you about it? And I was like, well, I didn't think that that's what you wanted.
And they're like, Reese, that's your thing. That's the thing that makes you special. That's your thing. They were like, out of all the things that you've sung for us, that sounds the most natural.
I was like, oh, okay. So I played them some other things that I'd written. And then they were just like, no, this is it. This is what you're doing. From 18 on, like that was That was it. Like, we went full tilt, but they gave me the confidence. You know, these two Black women that I was looking up to and really admired were telling me that it was okay. I was like, okay, cool.
If they're cool with it, then I'm cool.
Now, I want to find out about, and you said you moved to St. Louis or outside St. Louis around 12 years old. So let's just start a middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And middle school is about fitting in and making sure you don't stick out so people don't make fun of you. So here you are in the car, Linda Ronstadt, Dolly Parton, Patsy Cline. Mom pulls up or you pull up. All the other sisters are right there. The brothers are right there. All the other people are right there. And you got to go, nah, I got to take that off. We talk about, for Black folks, a double consciousness. So now you're adding country music into that. So you're doubling the double. You know what I'm saying? You're doubling the double. So how is it not hiding yourself, but in a sense, hiding who you were, and just specifically those middle school years?
Well, I'll say this. Like, my parents allowed me to be me. Like, let me fly my free flag. My dad calls me Denise. Out of all the Huxtable kids, he's like, you're my Denise.
You know, I dressed weird, and I did all the things. I was a Black kid that was living in the suburbs. And then when we moved to St. Louis, the neighborhood that we moved to had a program which they just ended in the last 2 years, called voluntary desegregation. That sounds insane.
Wait, it's still in the 90s?
In the 90s.
I know, that's what I'm saying. It sounds crazy. They just ended it 2 years ago.
For those of you that don't know, I'm going to give you a very quick Cliff Notes history lesson on St. Louis. It was one of the sites of the Red Summer where they were having race riots. There was a race riot in St. Louis. So it has always been an extremely segregated place. I'll just say it this way. If voluntary desegregation wasn't a thing, I would have been maybe one of three Black students in the entire school district. Thank God for the program, because it brought people that looked just like me into the county. But unfortunately, these kids were being driven from East St. Louis, from the city of St. Louis, an hour into the county to go to school. So they're not in their neighborhoods. They're not around anything that's familiar. They're in this very white situation. I mean, we all were, even though I lived there, like, it was still was other. And so I feel like I've been preparing for this career all my life, just by the circumstances that I grew up in. And, you know, we're of the generation where a lot of Black families thought that taking your children out of the hood, taking your children out and putting them in the suburbs and giving them what you feel is the best, what you see is the best, you think is the best. I don't know that I believe that anymore. So there was always double consciousness because, you know, I was a Catholic school kid. It was a very good school,
education-wise. And so when I started going to public school, it was like,
I'll never forget, like, my first day of seventh grade, there were two pregnant girls. And I was just blown away. I was just like, what? You're allowed to do that? Like, so it was completely, like, foreign to me, because I had been in this other very sheltered situations. You know, in school, I ended up in, like, the gifted program and all these different things. And to a lot of my Black counterparts, it was like, oh, you know, Reese's like, are you mixed? You must be mixed. Right. And I'm like, no, definitely not mixed.
You're like, oh, well, you know, you kind of talk like a white girl. You cool, but you kind of talk like a white girl. And then to white kids,
I'm not white enough to be like them.
And so you're just kind of in the middle on your own, doing your own thing.
I learned very quickly how to exist in both lanes. And thank God my parents instilled in me, like, being an individual. So I just kind of did my own thing. And whoever liked me. And those were my friends. And that was my situation.
This is early to mid-90s. The Midwest is emerging as producing their own hip-hop sound. So there's this pride that you start seeing late in the 90s when Nelly drops in 99, 2000. As a young person at that time, are you hearing? Because your ears have already been tuned to different kinds of music from your summers in Somerville. Are you hearing these different threads coming out of St. Louis? And were you going to clubs, sneaking into clubs? I mean, what was high school Reese and Palmer like?
Oh my God, hot mess. So I was like super goody-goody.
Like, totally, like, I wasn't...
Oh, those really are the worst people. They're goody-goody in public, but they're doing the shit So what is Reese Palmer doing? Straight-A student, sneaking into clubs, going to see Nelly?
Yeah. I that was okay. So the hip hop scene for real was
burgeoning, and in that time, like you said, I got very into hip hop, like very into hip hop in high school because of my friends, and so I'm listening to what they're listening to. So Saints was a big thing. Saints was a roller skating rink / teen club in St. Louis.
I would go visit my girlfriends that lived in the city. I'd go stay with them on the weekend and hang out. We'd go to Saints to hang out. We'd listen, talk to boys, enjoy being kids and having fun. And we weren't drinking and we weren't doing drugs or anything like that. We're just dancing and listening to music and singing. And there was a studio at Saints, like a recording studio. And I remember I would go and I would stand. You could watch from the roller, like from the dance club / roller skating rink. You could look in and see people recording. And that's actually where Nelly recorded all those demos that he and the St. Lunatics, like that became Country Grammar. You know, you'd see everybody, any of the local rappers, singers, whatever. And I was like, God, one day I'm going to get to record in a studio like that. That'll be awesome.
So you said you ran into these two female sort of who became mentors. And this mm-hmm. is through high school years. Are you performing at this time? How are you building that base? And I can do this country thing.
So I started performing when I turned 16. I went to church with a girl by the name of Essence Randolph. And she was Miss Talented Teen Missouri. And her mother was talking to my mom. And was like, you should get Reese, because I was singing in church choir at this point. And so people knew I could sing because I was getting solos and stuff. And so Essence was a friend, and Essence was like, Reese, you should do the pageant. So I did this pageant, and I met a bunch of people, like made a bunch of friends with kids that were just like me, girls that were singers and kind of like dreaming about the day you could leave St. Louis to go be a superstar. There was a group that Essence was in that was called Team 11, and it was sponsored by the local
WB affiliate in St. Louis, KPLR-TV. We were basically, it was just like a group of us, kind of like a Mickey Mouse Club kind of thing, where during the summers they would tape us. And now Jenny Jones, like that kind of thing. We did state festivals, state fairs, private events, like just all these random things. We played at colleges, all that. And that's where I got started.
And then two of the biggest producers in the history of music, Jimmy Jam and Terry. And again, and these guys are coming off Janet Jackson.
Yeah.
The biggest huge producers in the world. And you, Ms. Reese Palmer, say no.
No.
So let's talk about how you met them in that little journey, and then why no at 19, 20, where this could be it. It took a lot of cojones, miss, a lot of cojones.
Crazy. I'm crazy for feeling.
So I was in the airport in Atlanta. I had moved to Atlanta by this point with the two female managers. And
we were going, I forget where we were going. I think I was going to an audition. That's what it was. I was going to an audition in New York.
I had my guitar on my back and I'm walking through the airport.
Terry Lewis sees me.
And he goes,
hey, you play that thing?
I turned around and looked and I was like, that's Terry Lewis, because they have the dress.
Like, you just know who they are.
The fedora, they had the black suit with the tie, the whole thing?
Yes, the whole thing.
And so I was like, oh my God, you're you. And he started laughing
and he was like, yeah. And I said, yes, I do. And he says, what's your name? And I said, I'm Reese Palmer. Nice to meet you. And he says, nice to meet you. He said, what do you sing?
And I said, I sing country. And he starts laughing. He's like, no, you don't. And I said, I do.
And I said, here. And I had demos because, of course, every aspiring artist, you have your demo on you.
So I hand him my demo and it has, I was like, all the information's on the back. Take a listen. And he's going, he's like, I'm going to listen to this.
And so he leaves, goes to his flight. I go to mine. So by the time we land, there's a message on the voicemail
from Terry, like, you really do sing country. And he's like, this is amazing.
We would like to set up a meeting with you. Are you going to be in the LA area anytime soon?
And so, of course, my managers and I are like, yes,
that's what we want. so we leave New York
and go to Los Angeles. He sets up a meeting. We go to this like hotel suite.
His A&R people are there.
And publicity people are there.
It was like a 5-hour meeting. We ended up sitting and talking, just really vibing.
I sang and I played and
we talked about my dreams, my goals and everything. And
needless to say, they made an offer that day. We were ecstatic. Like, we were great. So we left LA, came back to Atlanta. We're like, this is, it's on.
Reese's about to get signed. We're celebrating.
Then we start having conversations about creative and what's going to happen. I realized that their vision for me is very different than the vision that I have for myself. They were like, well, you know, we don't really do country. That's not our thing. We see you more as like a pop artist. So we'd like to, you know, get that going with you, and you can incorporate acoustic sounds or whatever. But after that, and then like the type of deal they were offering, because the women at the time that I was signed to
wanted a production deal rather than just a straight up record deal.
And I was very loyal to them, sometimes to my detriment. So all these things partnered together said to me that this isn't the right situation for you. And so I very reluctantly told them that I would have to decline the deal. And everybody in my life thought that I was insane. Everybody. And nothing came along again for another 7 years.
For 7 years until your first big hit, and we're going to get to that, in 2007, Country Girl. And I mean, let the folks know, it was one of the first Black women to be on the country charts in how long?
20 years at that point.
20 years. But for the 7 years prior, what are you doing? You said the opportunity like that did not come around. You know, we see the end product of stardom. See the people win the Oscar, win the Grammys. I think most people don't recognize it's what you talked about earlier. It's the girl that's reading the liner notes on every single record. That there's some work you have to do. There's some interest that you have to have. There's some passion that kind of propels you. And as faint as it might be during these 7 years, I want to know about that. What are you doing to kind of keep one foot moving forward so that when the opportunity comes in 2005, 2006, 2007, you're like, I'm in a better place and ready for it. Are you busking? Are you back to busking? Are you, you know, selling CDs out of the back of your car, masterpiece style? What are you doing between 1999, 2000, and 2007 when you pop?
In between all that time, so after Jerry Lewis and Jimmy Jam, I'm taking guitar lessons. I'm writing songs in Nashville. I would spend like a couple weeks with my publishers down there and staying at their house in their spare bedroom, writing songs, 2 songs a day, 2 writing sessions a day while I'm there for like 2 weeks. And then coming back to Atlanta and taking guitar lessons, taking voice lessons, writing incessantly, trying to just figure it out. So that was Atlanta. And then my manager was like, let's move to New York. So then we moved to New York.
And country music capital of the world, obviously.
Of the world. Of course, I had to get a job because New York is expensive. So I'm working retail. I'm singing commercials. I'm singing demos. You know, I start meeting friends. Like, I'm old enough to drink now, so I can go out with my friends and, like, the girls that I'm working with. And we just would go to random places, like, just random parties. There were a lot of pop-up parties, and so we would go to a lot of pop-up parties, go to a lot of shows. Like, live. I took advantage of the fact that there's a lot of live music, so I'd go see live music all the time. A lot of industry parties because you're trying to meet people and schmooze and do that whole thing. Just a lot of just arbitrary drinking for no reason. Like just going out and drinking with your friends and stumbling around the village and like that sort of thing. Like dive bars and that sort of thing. Dating ridiculous people. And
oh, let's get into that. Who ridiculous? That says there's a story there. Maybe hubby already knows or he don't know. So maybe
he's exclusive here.
So when you say ridiculous people, I'm thinking like people who end up becoming somebody. I don't want you to have to drop names. But that's the vibe I'm getting. You're meeting other people who eventually become somebody.
It's the early aughts. And so, you know, there's athletes and football players and basketball
players. I'm trying to think who's on the Jets and the Giants in the early aughts.
Just because you're in New York doesn't necessarily mean you're playing.
Because you're coming through.
Basketball player. I mean, I've dated some of everybody. Exotic dancer, athlete. I had fun. I feel like every young person should have that experience of going to New York and eating combos for lunch because you don't have any money. But like going out with your friends and like just living that life, having that experience. I am richer. My life is richer for it.
Are you glad there was no social media then? Like there would be.
Yes.
You don't know. Sometimes I look at Baller Alert on Instagram and I'm like, oh, but for the grace of God, go I.
So then grab the microphone and let your words rip.
Now here's a funky introduction of how nice I am.
In between all that, there was a near miss with Brian McKnight. We worked together. We actually got in the studio and recorded a couple of things. And then literally 9/11 happened. I was supposed to fly to New York to have a meeting
with his label and he was going to sign me.
And 9/11 happened. We couldn't travel for a while. And then
what was like, oh, well, we'll do it in a couple weeks, turned into like 6 months and then never happened.
And then I met Prince
while I was in New York because of my attorney.
And Prince and I, for about 3 years, he would fly me to wherever he was. We would hang out. Nothing romantic. I did not date Prince. But he was married.
Exclusive, exclusive. Mama did not date Prince.
No,
he did not.
He was like a mentor.
Like he was being like a mentor. He would listen to my songs. He would ask me to send him anything that I was writing or working on. And then he would send me notes. Or tell me, you know.
Did y'all collab? Any kind of collaboration?
We didn't.
Prince vaults out there that we're going to hear 50 years from
now? We didn't end up going into the studio because he was mostly in LA and I was in New York. And I ended up signing a deal, which he told me not to. The deal that eventually brought Country Girl.
He did not want me to sign it.
Why not? What was your trepidation?
He was like, if they really believe in you and if they really care about you,
they wouldn't ask you to sign away so many of your rights and so many things. Like, that was his whole thing, was not signing away my rights. And Lord, do his words reverberate in my ear now.
But I was young, I was excited, and I wanted to be signed. Like, that's what everybody wants. Everybody wants to be signed. I ended up taking a deal anyway.
Did your managers were also advising you kind of what Prince was saying, or they were like, man,
no,
you gotta hit
like,
something, you gotta do something. Okay.
No, they were like, sign the deal. Because they ended up having a larger share of
my money than I did.
What's your relationship with those folks now?
We don't talk.
Industry rule number 4080. Record company people are shady. So kids watch your back, cause I think they smoke crack. I don't doubt it. Look at how they act.
Going through, you know, some interviews and things from you. You said, your words here, what seems like a detour brings you right back home. I think you were talking about your, you know, we're going to get to your new album, the one that came out in 2019, Revival, and kind of what you're doing now. That, you know, the 7 years in the wilderness, and now you're back to your roots, back to what you started out loving. Anyway, what seems like a detour has brought you back home. So now we're situated around 2005, 2006. You take that deal, you move back to Nashville.
I already had a system and friends and all that set up by the time I moved there.
But this was the first time that I was there, like 24/7,
365.
And we just worked on the record. And so Country Girl came about because of Corey Rooney. Corey Rooney produced Mariah Carey, Destiny's Child.
He's produced everybody. Mary J. Blige, like Jennifer Lopez.
He was in New York and he was friends with my old managers. They had worked out a deal
between themselves that he would produce some of the songs
because he wanted to get into country.
And he had done some things with Jessica Simpson for her country record.
They had tracks left over and he was like, oh, well, Reese could write something to this. So he gave me the track for what became Country Girl.
That song took the longest. Because all the other songs on the record I had been writing over the years.
So they already were what they were. But we needed like that one song. First, I wanted to say something about being black. Because I was just like, I feel like if I say it, then everybody would be like, oh, okay.
Rather than trying to talk around it or pretend like it wasn't a thing. And I was like, if I say it, then it breaks the ice.
There were lines in the song originally about me being black. And then everybody was like, maybe don't do that. So then I changed it, but the song, when you listen to it, it's about being different and not fitting into the box, but still being
that thing.
And that thing being country.
Like, what does it mean to be country? Like, you don't necessarily have to check off all these
things in order to be country. You can just be. It's a state of mind. And that ended up being the first single.
You also mentioned around that time that I guess the powers that be are asking, how are we going to market this young lady? How are we going to make her relatable? Basically, how are we going to make white people accept her? How difficult was it to have and hear those conversations where you're finding the place where you're doing your thing and now the business part of it comes in and that takes on a heavy racial element anywhere, but particularly in country?
It makes you feel like
you're a problem to be solved. The overwhelming message that I was getting was like, you're a problem. You don't have to be a Georgia peach from Savannah Beach to say. Your hair is a problem. Your skin is a problem. who you choose to date or not date is a problem.
Are there conversations like that, seriously, with an emerging artist? You have to date this person.
Well,
you have to date this person with a Q rating so your Q rating can go up. Are those conversations really happening?
The issue of who I was dating came up because of love interest in a video.
And so I did a song called No Air toward the end of my time with my record label. And it's a love song. It's a song about broken heart and like breaking up. If I was a white girl, we would just hire a model and I'd be rolling around on the beach and that'd be the end of it. But it was literally a conversation of who her love interest should be. Should it be a white guy? Should it be a black guy? Should it be nobody? There was a particular person that I wanted, a guy that was a model, and he was black. Everybody was like, no, I don't know. I don't know. So if you notice, if you look at that video, there's no love interest. There's nobody but me. I'm just wandering around the beach by myself, singing to this unknown person. In talking to people for Color Me Country, that seems to be a very common theme in a lot of people of color's videos. Nobody knows who you should be singing to.
You're a country girl.
Thank God for Donna Lisa. Donna Lisa was the PR at the label. She's a black woman, really amazing woman. Donna Lisa was like, can I just do a photo shoot with her?
I have friends and they'll shoot her for free, they said, just to take some test shots. We did this shoot, ended up being my pub pictures. And it's just me. I dressed how I wanted to dress. I put my own outfits together. We went in the streets of New York and Soho and just took pictures
with me and my guitar and my hair and everything. And those ended up being the promo shot. Understand, let me hear you all clap your hands.
Yeah. If you hear me and you know you're bad, all your country girls. If you are just joining us, we are on Ubuntu People's Podcast with Miss Reese Palmer. She is a country music maven at this point. One of the few black women, successful black women in the industry. We're talking about her time kind of popping in 2007 with your first big hit, Country Girl. How did the song do? And what was that life like? So you're building 7 years in the wilderness. You're there. This song pops, gets in the top 100, top 50, is going up the charts. What is life like?
Very busy. So a lot of people don't know, but to get your song up the chart, you have to do a lot of radio stuff. So I was doing radio tours at that point. I wasn't really like at home really enjoying all these things because I was on the road, sometimes two cities a day, going to radio stations and shaking hands and kissing babies and eating pizza and going to steakhouses and hanging out, you know, having beers and stuff with radio people. Radio, country radio is unlike any other medium because streaming does well and people do well on streaming. But like most country listeners get new country music from country radio. So you kind of live and die by what happens on radio tour. I mean, I have literally played like at car dealerships,
random bars, guitar pools at like water parks. That's the life of a country artist. Like you were literally playing all these things, livestock, judgings, state fairs, county fairs.
I can't tell you how many county fairs I played. Just doing
the thing. That's the circuit.
You know, I had a video out, and so
like you have to do promotion for videos, so you're doing interviews. It's a lot. It's a lot. And I was tired. As the song climbed, the song ended up in the 40s and it stopped there.
You know, a lot of people have
different theories as to why it stopped there, but it stopped there. And we started working a new song.
But
making it to the 40s made me the first black woman in 20 years to get on the country chart. And so then that became a talking point. And then that was the only thing that anyone wanted to ask me about
for a very long time,
which was really annoying because
I was a brand new artist that had written 12 of the 13 songs on her debut album,
which is like, doesn't happen.
Does not happen. Nobody trusted the artist. Let's get some people that we know. Put her voice to their tracks and let's hope magic happens.
I would have much rather been talking about that. The fact that, you know, you wrote all this stuff. And I can't blame radio or media. It was also my record company was pushing this narrative as well. And so all these people
were coming together to single me out again.
As a black artist in a mostly white genre, yes, you want to fit in. And fit in meaning you want to be considered a singer just like everybody else.
You don't want to be given anything special just because you're black.
But you also don't want to be excluded just because you're Black. And you don't want to have to change who you are in order to fit in. And so it's a really strange dichotomy and line that you're walking when you're doing this. That was hard. And it was very hard. There were people that were very kind. I had champions along the way, for sure. But I also had people that were just like, we are not fucking playing this Black woman ever.
To my radio team.
Wow.
Because again, I had in between, so I didn't have to necessarily hear some of this stuff.
You know, and then there's microaggressions. Like you go into the radio station and they want to do like an authenticity test. I remember once I was on live radio and they start playing like these obscure old country songs to see if I knew what they were.
Wow.
And so I played along and I knew a lot of them. And I think they were really surprised that I knew them. But I remember asking another artist that I knew that was on basically doing the same stations that I was doing. I was like, did they do that to you? And he was like, nah,
we just talked about sports and stuff. And I was like, huh, interesting.
So like a lot of authenticity testing,
a lot of, so talk about being Black. How's that going? How's it in country doing that for you?
Being told like, well, you're not like Black. Like you're different. Or,
you know, Risa, you don't talk like whatever, or you don't sound like, or you don't do this, or you don't do that. Or like this automatic, oh, you're so soulful. Your voice is just so soulful.
And it's like, mind you, soulful's great, but like, am I really all that soulful? Or are you just saying that because...
And then I'm a woman too. So then you get like sexually harassed. So you're like, people want like, send me a picture of your boobs.
Like, wait a second, like radio people? DJs and shit like that? Damn, so when Kanye loses his mind or when another artist... does something that the public goes, they're a little off. It's all this shit. It's all this shit behind the scenes that nobody ever sees and nobody ever notices. It's the price of fame and the price of stardom. And if you're willing to pay it, God bless you. But it sounds like there's a lot to be lost in terms of truth-telling and authenticity, which we're going to get to, which I find is, I think, the phase that you're in now. And we're going to get to that. But at that point, who are you confiding in? Who are you going, these motherfuckers, what the fuck is, you know what I'm saying? Who are the people that you're going, I got to tell you my truths. Okay. Shout them out. Who are they? I'm sure they know. But shout them out again. Let them know.
My Autumns, I had two Autumns in my life, two Black women. One is an artist and still is an artist.
And the other I've known since I was 5 years old. And so we're all very tight. And I would talk to them. I had my girlfriends, Holly and Angie. And Rosalind in Nashville that I would talk to, my boy Jason. Like, I had my people. And I loved my radio team. Like, my radio team worked their asses off for me. And, you know, in really kind of jacked up conditions sometimes. But they did. They went hard for me. You know, at the end of the day, I'm the one in the front. I'm the one that's taking all the hits. And so I'm the one that they're calling names on the internet. I'm the one that they're making fun of, that people are sending me hate mail to and that sort of thing. And so I'm the one taking it. So I started drinking. Like, so anytime I was home, I was drunk.
Damn, like, this is what years. This is again.
This is like 2007, 2008.
With self-medicating.
And, oh yeah.
With alcohol. When did you sort of rise out of that? I don't want to say spiral. That seems too damning. But that.
No,
that,
it was a spiral.
It was okay. So then, where'd you get yourself out of that spiral, girl?
So all these great things are happening seemingly on the outside, and then on the inside, it's just like it's hell. At that point, I had developed
nodes on my vocal cords, and so I was having a really hard time singing and talking.
And I truly believe, looking back on it in lots of therapy,
that it was psychosomatic as well as physical.
And I believe in God, and so I believe that when you're not using your voice to speak up for yourself or to speak up for the right things, then God takes it. And so that's what happened. So 2009 was all those things coming to a head, all the drinking, all the partying, all the dumb relationship decisions and like stupid things that you shouldn't have done, but you did because you're young and dumb or whatever. The tension with the record label, everything came to a head.
I was like, I gotta get out of this. I have to get out of this. This is terrible. them telling me they weren't going to release a second album was the final straw.
So I ended up filing bankruptcy at the beginning of 2009, spent an entire year fighting to get out of my record deal because the record company contested it. And so we had to go to trial. I couldn't perform because they owned my name. And so I finished out everything that I had contracts for as far as shows. And then there was no money coming in. I had to get a job. I got a regular job working retail. Wow. And I'll never forget, at the mall in Nashville, where everybody knows me now because I'm the only one. It's me and Darius Rucker at this point. So people are in the mall like, aren't you? And my store was right across from the Apple store. And we had a deal with the Apple store to play my video for no air. So I'm seeing myself every hour and hour. It was hard. And eventually I had to go home because I couldn't even afford to keep up my apartment and all the stuff because I was working a minimum wage job when I had just been making $10,000, $15,000 a pop.
Yeah. Where was home? You said you had to go home. Back to the Lou? Back to Georgia?
Well, so at this point, my parents had moved from St. Louis to Ohio. So I went home. I went to Ohio and stayed with my parents for about 6 months and tried to figure out my life while I was going to trial, while I was paying an attorney. And just my life was just fucking falling apart. Like, it was just, it was the hardest time of my life, but I am so grateful for it.
So what got you through that?
Faith and my family. There's no air. If I didn't have the safety net that I have, that's why I have a lot of sympathy for people that end up on the street or end up living in their cars while they're working, like the working poor, because that was me, essentially. Like, I was working a minimum wage job. I didn't finish college, and so, like, there wasn't any, like, I couldn't go be, like, a paralegal or something. I was working this job trying to save myself, get myself out of this really toxic situation, but I wasn't making enough money to get an apartment. If it weren't for my parents being like, just come here, figure it out, you're working.
But get your house in order.
Like, if it wasn't for people doing, I don't know where I would be.
Again, the life of an artist, the life of a musician, we see the glitz, we see the glamour, we don't see the pain in the work. And it's unfortunate that it is the pain that sometimes leads to great art.
Yeah.
And again, people, there's a fine line we got to walk as creatives because we don't want to simmer and delve into it too deep because we get stuck there. Not everybody can relate to happiness, and not everybody will, because not all of us are fortunate to have the levels of happiness that we want. We aspire to want something, but once we recognize that sometimes the place that we get to, it wasn't anything that we thought it was going to be. And it's a lot less sometimes, so we feel disappointed. But everybody can relate to pain. Even a child, as young as our kids now, 2 years old, like when my daughter cries, you know, sometimes I'm going, come on, let's just, it's a boo-boo, let's get over. But I know I have to go
with this.
Because it's pain to her.
It's pain
to her right now. So everybody can relate to pain. It's the whole idea of struggling and emerging from it that I think anybody can sort of latch onto and go, yeah, I fucks with Rishi Palmer because I understand what she went through. We're going to get to where you are now doing the, that's ironic, the show for Apple that was right across the street from you.
Isn't that funny?
Life works that way sometimes. When you're in your truth, and I firmly believe this, when you're in your truth doing your shit, the universe conspires to help you. And the universe conspires to show you signs along the way that you reflect on later on and go,
yeah,
it was always there. The thread was always, always there.
I'm getting emotional just thinking about that. That's so true.
No, it is. You can look back through your life and you see there were signs, there were positives, there were things that says, you were literally looking at Apple every single day. There's some sort of spiritual kind of truth to that, right? You're looking at the destination where you're at right now. And if we sit back sometimes and really pay attention to it, we see our road. We're just sometimes taken off it. Like you said, what seems like a detour brings you right back home. You are back home. We're going to talk about your album Revival, which I don't know another better title than coming back home and kind of reigniting yourself than that. But one of the things that you said, and I wanted to find out why you said that, but now after hearing your story, I get it. In talking about highlighting the Black women in country, when talking about some of them, highlighting what you're doing now with Apple Radio, telling the stories of folks like Linda Martell, says, I just don't want anybody to die feeling like they're forgotten and that they don't matter. Mm-hmm. I know what that feels like. And I was trying to figure out, all right, this lady, what is she talking about?
Why does she feel like that?
Why? She has There's no cancer. There's no, like, she's not hospitalized. You know what I'm saying? What? But yeah. I get it. It's like the death of an artist. Your sense of who you are between 2007 and 2009 and going into the alcohol and shit like that is destruction, is death.
Yeah.
And then in Ohio, you got to be reborn. So I'm looking at that going, I just don't want anybody to die feeling like they're forgotten and that they don't matter. Of course, at some point you go, I'm the lady who was on CMT 6 months ago and now I'm working at retail. It's death. Death of an ideal, death of an image, death of a version of you.
Yeah.
So what brought you back? Because you're doing new music now. Put out a new album. Let's talk about revival. Let's talk about family and faith. What was it? What was it that got you out and got you started on this new detour?
God, I hate to sound like a cliche, but it was a man.
Plug the man. Look, we don't get enough. People don't think that we want to hear that we're not emotional beings, and we don't want to hear that somebody. No, let's plug this man. Let's tell this man what he did for you here.
In the midst of this trial and everything, my husband Brian and I, we met 8 years earlier. But I didn't really take him seriously because, again, he was too nice.
I needed crazy. And so
I'd kind of kept him at bay for all these years. And then we just started talking again, just over social media or whatever. And it just so happened that he had a business trip in Ohio near where my family lived. He offered to take me out to dinner and just on some friend stuff, not a date.
We ended up leaving that date knowing that we were going to spend the rest of our lives together.
He is the reason I left Nashville. Because after the trial,
after I won my freedom in the bankruptcy, I went back to Nashville to try to get started again
and found that a lot of doors were closed.
A lot of the goodwill that had been extended to me at that point was gone because at that point I was a failure.
Oh, well, you know, she didn't chart higher than
the 30s and the 40s and like, been there, done that, we're done.
Aside from like the friends and champions and people that I had in my life,
nobody was calling me back.
All the labels that said, yeah, we'll be interested. If you get out of your deal, we'll be interested. Nobody returned phone calls. Nobody was interested anymore, nothing. And so Brian and I started developing our relationship and he would fly from here to Nashville like every couple weeks to spend time with me. And after about 6 months, we were like, well, what are we doing?
Like, let's just get married.
I left Nashville in June of 2010. I married Brian in July of 2010. And I was pregnant with my oldest daughter in September of 2010. And that
was the end of music for a while.
I just was a housewife. I was preparing for my wedding and then I was preparing for my baby. It was doing baby music that got me back into
music again.
So say that again. What? You dropped a baby album?
We went to baby music, me and my mommy and me music class. And I was listening to this music and I was like, God, I could do this. Like, this will be nothing. I said, this will be fun. And like, my only hope was,
you know, I get to write and record. It's not as dangerous as trying to be in the real music business.
I can sell these to like baby music classes or whatever, and it'd be fun.
So I called friends from Nashville.
We did a children's album. It's called Best Day Ever. We dropped it in 2013.
And that is what got me doing music again. I got bit by the bug a second time, and I was just like, this feels good. I remember this. The album grew legs, and I was able to play at Lincoln Center in New York. I've been on two Hallmark compilations with that children's album. And just like it's led to other collaborations and other things that I've been able to do. And so I thank God for that record. Best day ever.
People got to go out and cop this. They got to go get this.
Yeah, go get it.
A lot of these children's albums is like standard songs and just have their own spin on it. Or is it?
No, it's all original music.
We spent a weekend writing songs while Grace, my oldest, was like a year old. And like, well, at the time she was 9 months. And so she's crawling around the studio and you can actually hear her on some of the tracks in the background because she slept in a bassinet in the vocal booth while I did vocals. It was like truly a family thing. My husband was there in the studio.
I was like, okay, I think I'm ready.
I'm not scared anymore. Cause I developed anxiety, stage anxiety, everything because of everything that had happened.
So then I did a project called the Backport Sessions in 2015. and started playing coffee houses. I went from playing theaters, being an opening act for people and playing on television and all this stuff, to playing like coffee houses in North Raleigh. Did that for like a couple years, and it just started building and building. And people are like, hey, aren't you? Didn't I? Weren't you? I just have been building ever since then, getting more things, teaching. I started teaching at Welltown Children's Theater. Shout out to them. Love them here in Durham. Just developing my confidence, because I lost a lot of confidence in that I could even do this, or that I was even supposed to do this. Thank God for detours. Seriously. So led me to 2019, which was a revival. And revival was just like, like everything that I've been feeling, everything that I've been thinking, everything that I've been writing that whole time came to a head. You know, I care a lot more about politics and social justice than I did as that 25-year-old kid that signed to a record company. I care a lot about my community, a lot more about my community, about my people, than I did as a 25-year-old trying to make it in Nashville. I decided to pour all of that into this record. And so that's what revival is. It was like me coming out of the fear, the shame, the anxiety, all of that, and just being me unapologetically. And like, I don't care that some of these songs have horns and that some of this stuff sounds like funk as opposed to country. I don't give a shit. Like, this is, it's all of that. Right. Everything's in it. And so, yeah. It's probably the realest thing I've ever done.
Trapped in darkness, waiting for the light, cold and heartless. Something right.
That's what was my introduction to you, hearing Revival. Again, we meet at the meeting at the daycare center. This is who you are. This is my name. We Google you on the way home, driving 20 minutes home, and the first song that pops up is Revival, right? I told you the next time I saw you, because we listened to that, then we're reading on, and she goes, oh, the biggest hit was Country Girl. So I go listen to Country Girl. Again, I don't know jack for music, right? But my impression of the two songs, and it's fortunate that I listened to the project you would consider the definition of you so far, the most realist thing that you've ever done. And I heard that. Then I heard Country Girl, and I told you, it sounded like Carrie Underwood or somebody. It sounded like, and you said, it was written for Jessica Simpson. So I'm going, it was,
the track,
for me,
yeah.
It was, I know you wrote the lyrics, and the story is definitely yours. The lyrics are you. But it was like, I could put any other white girl on this track, maybe not singing the lyrics, but the sentiment would come out. When I heard Revival, I'm like, that's soul. That's gospel, that's home. It sounded like literally you're in your house on your guitar and I'm just doing my shit and I feel comfortable doing it. All the more reason why when we look on your website, the first video we see on the way down is seeds. Talk to us about seeds, because we started this conversation about three songs that you did at the Grand Ole Opry. First one was Somerville, about your folks home in Northern Georgia. And now, after folks hearing all the shit you've been through since 2000, when we say and you say what it meant to go back to the Grand Ole Opry after not being there for 13 years, I'm hoping at this point, if folks are still listening, they understand the gravity of that. And then you making the decision to sing Seeds. Now, tell the story about Seeds, how it came about.
Yeah.
I'm a storyteller, Reese. I'm a storyteller. I try to
make people look
good.
You are.
Yeah. Talk to us about Seeds.
Seeds came from 2014 from Michael Brown. I wrote that while I was watching them announce on CNN that they were not going to charge the cop and the subsequent uprisings that happened in Ferguson. The producer of Revival is from Ferguson, Missouri. I know people from that area that were affected. And like everybody else, I was
hurt and pissed and frustrated and everything. And like trying to figure out, okay, what's the spin? How do I think through this?
I saw this quote. They tried to bury us. They didn't know that we were seeds. And I was like, that's it.
Brothers and sisters, don't believe what you've been sold. They can bury your body, but never touch your soul.
And so that video, it happened at a time in my life. We had just lost a baby.
You know, I was dealing with the aftermath of having a miscarriage and
just really probably low
like a low point, like lower than I had been in a really long time.
Making that video just recharged and
rejuvenated and like,
let's go. And so after I made this video, we went into the studio and finished the rest of the record. It turned off a lot of people, made a lot of people angry.
Ooh. A lot of people. Ooh. That
what
really
types
fans.
Of people? What types of Ooh. People? Who's pissed off at this?
Boots run deep because we are seeds. When we rise up, no weapon can.
A lot of people inbox me. I won't be following you anymore, but I guess you don't care. And like that sort of thing. If you see this video and the first thing that you think is, I can't follow her anymore
right.
because of these messages, then you probably don't need to be following. Because you that means you're okay with this. Like you just, the only problem you have is me putting in the video. Like you don't have an actual problem with children on the border in Cape. You don't have a problem with young black men being gunned down in the street.
You just don't like that it's in my video. I take on the idea of there are enough people that do get it and that do like me and do appreciate it.
I'm fine with separating
the chaff and the seed, so to speak.
Are there other folks in country who are progressive enough to sing about these things? Or is it sort of a topic that everybody who's successful in the industry knows their audience, so they can't do Blue Lives, they can't do BLM.
People!
Are there people, and let's just be frank, are there white people saying this shit? Because one of the things that I, and again, not to say that they have to say it so it becomes important, but this is the history of music in this country. The Bob Dylans of the world. Bob Dylan was getting played on black radio in the 60s.
Right.
Bob Dylan was speaking a truth that resonated with us. One, because
yeah.
we knew nobody would listen to us and they would listen to him. This is the first time ever saying this out loud, but I think Bruce Springsteen is an overrated hack. I think because...
Wow.
No, because this is why. Because you are getting credit. You are getting credit for saying shit that a decent human being should be saying. Like these people, these artists, these
I see what you're saying.
Progressive white artists who they prop up. Oh my God, he made, you're saying shit that says just treat people like human beings.
Treat people like human beings.
We say that and you don't listen to us. Reese Palmer says that, you don't listen to her. But go let somebody else say treat people like human. This is not a stretch of intellectual prowess and moral fortitude to say whatever it is that Bruce Springsteen has said that people go, oh my God. It's as if they get credit for putting their arms around black people. And I have a problem with that. I have a problem with that. Because you should be putting your arms around us anyway. We're human beings. We're living a life just like yours. So first time I've ever said that. Wonderful musician, wonderful artist, Bruce Springsteen, American icon. But I have a problem with people giving these soulful
cookies.
Yeah,
I call it
white folks
people.
Credit for shit you should know.
Yeah.
You should know this and say this.
I call it giving people cookies. Like, so would you like a cookie for that?
So are there any mainstream country artists?
Oh yeah.
White country artists saying this, the BLM and
there
saying the truth of America.
Maren Morris is one. Jason Isbell is one. Cam is one.
You know, Chris Stapleton was brave enough to say it. I've always been a Chris Stapleton fan and it made me like him even more. Because he publicly was like, yes, I believe Black Lives Matter. And like,
this is like a dumb thing for us to even be discussing. And people were pissed.
You know, and Dolly Parton said it. And then everybody was angry. Like, what?
Vince Gill put out a song called March On recently, talking about the protests and everything. People were pissed. But like the person that really stepped out again was a black woman, Nikki Guyton, with her song Black Like Me.
Little kid in a small town, I did my best just to fit in.
That was the follow-up to a song called What Are You Gonna Tell Her? That was about sexual harassment
and like just the things that women go through.
And so again, you have a black woman. I call us the canary in the coal mine.
Like, we are always in there trying to stand up and be like, all right, y'all, this is not working.
Right.
It's not working for anyone. It's definitely not working for us, but it's not working for you either, white women. It's not working for you, black men. It's not working.
You know, and then you're called
loud or troublemaker or whatever. There are a few that are standing up and that are saying these things, and they're getting heat for it. You know, Maren Morris stood at the CMAs last year and said all of our names
on stage when she accepted Female Vocalist of the Year. She didn't have to do that. I didn't know she was going to do it. None of us expected her to do it. But she did. It was very big of her. It was a very big deal. And I remember it was all over the news the next day. There are people trying to do the work.
There are.
You're one of them with
I'm
your.
I'm trying.
You're one of them with your Apple show. And so we're gonna get to that now. Your show on Apple Radio, Color Me Country, and again, you're speaking about this hidden history, this silent history, this forgotten history, this music history about our contribution to country. When did that idea burgeon up, and when did you start doing it?
One of my best friends, Shelly Warren, had been encouraging me to do it for years, to do a podcast. And I was like, girl, nobody wants to hear me. And she's like, girl, I don't want to hear you talking about this stuff. So you need to talk about it on a podcast. And she did. She was just like, and this is what you should talk. Like, this is what you're passionate about. You should talk about this stuff. I didn't really take it seriously until the beginning of quarantine. I had just been interviewed with Nikki for an article, Nikki Guyton, an article about Linda Martell, who is the first Black woman to ever play the Grand Ole Opry. First one signed. To this day, 1968, highest charting Black female ever in country music.
What number did she get to?
She got to the 20s. To this day, she is the highest charting.
We did this article because last year, 2020, was the 50th anniversary of her album, Color Me Country, which is why I named the show that.
Everybody likes to talk about the five Black people that they know of in country music. Darius Rucker, Charlie Pride, Jimmy Allen, Kane Brown, Nikki Guyton. I was excluded from that, which is fine. No big deal.
It's a hard life on easy street, just by painted picket fence.
Numerous other people. And then I started thinking about, well, what about Hispanic people? What about Native American people? Like, I know that they exist. I know that they were doing this, like, clearly. Because country music is a mixture of all these American art forms. It doesn't make sense that it's Lily White and then here comes Charlie Pride.
When we were in quarantine and all my shows were canceled for the year, I was just home
with my kids.
I knew everybody else was home. So then I just started calling all the artists that I knew. And I was like, hey, do you want to talk? And then I was going on Instagram, scouring Instagram, finding Black country artists, Hispanic country artists, Indigenous artists, and reaching out to them. Some of them knew me, some of them didn't. And I was just like, okay, this is who I am. This is what I'm trying to do. Do you want to do this? Some people didn't respond. Some people did. And so I ended up doing like 25 interviews before Apple came into the picture. A friend who was an Apple host, unbeknownst to me, had a podcast and had me on the show. And I talked about the show. And Kelly is her name. Kelly told Apple Music, you need to talk to Reese about this show. This is a good show. You need to sign this show.
A week later, I had a meeting.
They wanted to do the show.
Black smoke horizon and it surely is a train. Surely is a train, Lord, surely is a train.
What do these names mean to you? Brittany Spencer, Tierra, Chapel Hart, Raina Roberts, Nika Marks, Julie Williams. For a lot of people, they don't mean anything. What do they mean to you?
Well, Miko is my peer. Miko and I came out at the same time. Actually, Miko released an album before I did. And I was looking up to her. I was chasing her. She's like one of my best friends. I love her to death. She's amazing. Amazing. And I'm so glad that she is having a revival. She's having a resurgence right now, like she should. She's one of the best damn singers that I know. It's a damn shame that Nashville treated her the way that they did, because she was amazing. She is amazing. The rest of those girls, those are the babies. Those are the baby sisters. Those are my little sisters. My little loves.
They're the new generation. They're the ones. They're the hope.
They're the torchbearers.
Do you think, out of all the things that you've seen in your career in Nashville, the path is a little bit clearer for them? Or the obstacles are still the same, even in 2021?
I have hope
that things are going to be easier for them. Does my intuition tell me that? No.
But each one of them are equipped.
Better equipped than I was.
Based on the fact that there is a support system now. Other artists of color that you can reach out to, that you can talk to, that you can touch, that can offer support. Whereas I didn't have that. Again, it was just me, Nico, and Darius Rucker. Contrary to a lot of white people's beliefs, we don't all know each other. And so
I have hope in that the sisterhood, the brotherhood,
that they can have support and endure a lot better than we did.
Now, one of the things you said in that 2007-2009 era was that, obviously, you talk about the amount of time it takes to go through these promotions, radio promotion, just scouring the country, meeting and greeting, kissing babies, just letting them know, I really want this to happen, putting in the work. You also said it costs, the monetary cost of getting into the business and cutting albums and doing those sorts of things.
So Color Me Country has extended into a artist grant fund for BIPOC artists who are, I will never get used to using that. That's such a strange acronym. But anyway, BIPOC.
What is it? What does it say again?
It's like BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, People of Color.
Black smoke rising and it surely is a train.
Yeah, it's the new thing that people are using.
It encompasses all people of color that are trying to achieve a career in country music or Americana music. We talked a little bit about safety nets and how a lot of people don't have them. I was fortunate that I did, but I can't tell you what $1,000 would have done for me. Actually, I can. I can tell you what $1,000 would have done for me.
At that really critical juncture,
it kept me in town. It kept me
working when I was buying combos and Arizona teas
during the day
just so I had something to eat.
It's already hard enough being an artist.
Without having to think, Lord, I can't fix my teeth. Lord, I can't fix the car. I can't pay. Do I pay rent or do I do this demo? Or I would really love to do a visual for this, but I can't afford it.
It's expensive to be an artist and to look like you can keep up. Because people pay attention to that. Bookers pay attention to that. People that book shows pay attention to that. A&R people pay attention to that.
What the presentation is.
Do your pictures look professional? Does your video look professional?
Do your songs sound professional? Does your social media presence?
All of that matters. And that costs money. And in order to keep up on the level in which you have to be able to compete,
you need money.
So I didn't want money to be a reason why people stopped.
Why you didn't produce that project, why you didn't finish that.
So that's what the grants are for. There's not like an application or anything. Just hit me on social media. And people do it. They'll be like, hey, how do I get the, send me your PayPal. And I just send it out. And we've given over 50 plus since the beginning of the year.
But I hope people are using this platform that you've created so that more, because I think in one interview you mentioned that it's 0.03% of country music is Black women. How do we change that number? I know you're doing a project with Apple, and obviously just being yourself and literally being the revival is showing folks that we're not going to keep getting beat down about this and sink under and not tell our truths. By simply making the album, you are showing it. Or what is the engine? What is it going to take to get that number? About 0.03% of the
it's
music.
Horrible.
That is disgusting.
It's not great for Black men either, even though you see, you know, Jimmy Allen just... This morning, the CMAs announced their nominations, and Jimmy Allen and Mickey Guyton both got a Best New Artist nomination.
How long have they been in the business?
Mickey's been in the business for 10 years, and Jimmy has been in the business, Lord, about five okay. or 6 years? Yeah,
new artist. Anyway, we'll talk about that another time.
But, you know, Black men don't fare much better. It's going to take I hate to say this, I hate to be that person, but like, it's going to take a dismantling of the business. It's going to take internal work.
Like, it's not just who's in front of the camera. Who's running the camera? Who's making the decisions? Who's signing the artists? Who's producing the records? Who's writing the records? Who's signing the writers? Who's doing the PR? Who's taking the pictures? A whole change needs to happen in the industry. And it's not just country. It's all industry. Like, you see a lot of Black people, like, we know a lot of Black people in the music business, but, like, for real, it's like Diddy and, like, maybe Tip, like, you know what I'm saying? It's the same people.
And so, like, there has to be a system change, a whole cultural change. I mentioned cultural. There also has to be a cultural shift in the fandom.
Like, Black people, we're part of this, too. And so, like, taking ownership from the fans' perspective.
I'm not saying just support because there's Black people, just support them.
But kind of, we walked away from country music just as much as country music was, the narrative was hijacked from us. We walked away from it too.
It's reclaiming that and being proud of it and wanting to walk in that and be a part of it. I mean, the problem that plagues this country, it's not just country music, like this cultural thing that we've got going on, this nastiness, this thing that makes people send you messages like, I hope your Black ass dies or something like that. I get messages like that on a radio. You're a racist. You're racist against white people and that kind of thing. Yet and still, after Morgan Wallen said what he said in February, he had the number one album in all genres because people were defiantly supporting him. Not just supporting him, like defiantly supporting him.
For people who didn't know, what happened with Morgan?
Oh, Morgan Wallen
is a country artist, a pretty new country artist.
Just regular guy. He'd been pretty successful
with his first album. He released his second album.
Critically acclaimed, second album. And on the heels of that, got caught on video calling one of his friends a punk ass.
N-I-G-G-E-R with a hard emphasis on the
not the hard A. No. It was the E-R.
You know, he did his prerequisite apology tour.
Saturday Night Live made fun of himself doing it.
But mind you, he had been in trouble before. Like, he got kicked off of being on Saturday Night Live because he went out and got drunk
instead of staying in quarantine like they asked him to.
But then he got a second chance because, you know, he's a child, because white men are allowed to be children until they're like 35. And then
he did this. And then everybody in the industry either took two sides. They either were like, nah, hold him accountable.
Like, that's not good. That's not okay. Or he's a child. He made a mistake. Like, forgive him. It's okay. Don't punish him. But then the fans decided that they were not only going to support, but they were going to go crazy in their support. They bought billboards all over the country. They have harassed and attacked anybody that talks about him on social media, myself included, Nikki Guyton, Andrea Williams, like a lot of people that are activists in this arena were attacked.
And now he's fine. He gave some money to a black organization in Los Angeles,
didn't follow through with the NAACP, and now he's good. Like, he's booked on shows.
So there's a cultural shift that has to happen.
Now, we're going to start wrapping up here. We talk about the Grand Ole Opry not being there for 13, 14 years. You come back, and the last song that you chose to sing that night was a Linda Martell song. What song was it, and what was the meaning behind it?
I sang Bad Case of the Blues, which was her second song on the charts. And I get to yodel in that song. I just like yodeling. That was fun. I did it because, you know, she never came back. After she played the first few times, she didn't come back. And she was essentially banished from Nashville after she left. And so
I did it for her.
With a bad case of the blues. You're letting...
I think you're also doing it for, and again, I didn't know this name. You said it's one of your babies, Julie Williams. I look at her and I kind of see you when you got the frizzies, when you got the pictures of all your frizzies out.
Yeah.
There's a similarity there. And the one song that I know from her, Southern Girls, and there's no coincidence for me.
Produced the video, and the song was produced because of Columbia Country Artist Grant.
And then I think of Country Girl and Southern Curls, so the similarity is not lost on me. So even go back, just to kind of wrap all this stuff up, you go back to Beach Boys' California Girl, to the song about Americana. Obviously, David Lee Roth, I think Van Halen does something in the 80s with the same kind of idea. You do Country Girl in 2007. Tim McGraw does Southern Girl in 2013. And now one of your babies does Southern Curls. Now your song, I was figuring out how to say it, but you said it for me. When you're talking about going around to the radio stations and having to give your bona fides, I'm about this life. You have to prove to them.
Why the hell would I be here, right?
Why would I you would be there, right? And I think Southern Girl, as good of a song it is also that, folks, I'm about this life. This is me. Southern Curls, I thought was her taking the next logical step. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I look at Donald Glover and I look at Issa Rae, and there's this black authenticity in what they're spewing as their art, where it's not them trying to conjure up to white people and saying, accept us. No, it's, this is my life.
This is it.
It's varied. It's not maybe your conception of black life, but this is it. And all of it is black. The totality of it is black, just the fact that I'm here. So when I hear Julie Williams singing about being that young girl in middle school and the guy that you like doesn't like you because you're black and you look different, is just a truth that she's telling about her life without asking you to. I don't need your acceptance. I already know this. I'm just sharing my truth. And so when you see her and when you hear that, I don't want to say take credit. Do you see that connection? And do you see exactly what you're doing with your Apple Music show? The trajectory in the industry is going towards something that you ultimately want, where somebody like that is not afraid to say it. My Southern Curls. This is a black girl song. I don't care if you accept it or not, but it is what it is.
Southern baby, bow tied, big girl, white-eyed, new white shoes. Mama put my coat on, kissed me, and sent me off to school for my first.
These are new girls.
These ain't your mama's early 2000 girls. Julie in particular is fearless. She got fire for y'all. She got some other stuff
that she's planning on releasing soon. Karen McCormick, same thing.
Everybody's writing like these just very conscious, great songs that I never thought that I would hear
in country music. They're a lot more fearless than I was. Between Mickey and I hope
that we
have made it
them feel like it's okay and like they have a place to go. Like if the mainstream is not with it, like we're with it.
I'm a Southern girl with the wrong kind of Southern curve.
We got you.
And so,
yeah, I hope so. I can't take credit for it.
There's a trajectory. There's a definite trajectory.
Yeah, I work hard to make sure that they know that
I have their back.
Take it back to the streets. Like, you know, you're more likely to buck up if you know that somebody's standing behind you. Like, I got you. And so that's what this is to me. Like, I got you. Like, we got you.
And I think that's what the show is. Color Me Country is I got you. Color Me Country is I got you. I'm going to start listening some more. I hope folks can too. When can they hear this? Color Me Country on Apple Radio.
Every other Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern
to 9 p.m. Eastern on Apple Music Country. You just go to colormecountry.com and there's a link
to the show page, or you can just look it up on your Apple Music.
It's free if you listen when it's live
at 7. Or after that, you have to have a Apple Music subscription
to hear it on demand. It's good fun. We have a good time. I play what I want to play. And so, yeah, we have a good time.
It's worth it. I'm in. I've been saying for a long time, I got to find some new music. Listening to Julie or listening to some of the other folks that you've turned me on to, you know, I was waiting for 20 years to go, where is consciousness, right? And I've been waiting for it in the places that I sought it out and found it 20 years ago, hip hop, Mos Def, Talib Kweli. Mm-hmm. But I hear Julie Williams, I hear consciousness.
Yes.
This is an unexpected place. So I'm in. I want new things. I want new sounds as an artist. I want to be inspired by new things. I'm with them. Obviously, everybody's got the website. So it's reesepalmer.com. Yeah. Folks can go there, see everything you're doing. And also, tell them about September 21st for the local people.
Oh, so 22nd.
I'm playing at the American Tobacco. Duke University presents.
Come on out if you're
free.
If you're
and it's outside.
Come on out, support Miss Palmer. Definitely check her out on her show, Color Me Country.
Yeah, every other Sunday.
Again, I appreciate your time. I think you and I both got to do the same thing. I got to go drive to
pick
up Molly right now.
Kids.
I got to see this and go get the kids. But thank you very much, folks. The other names out there, Brittany Spencer, Tiara, Chapel Hart, Raina Roberts, Nika Marks, Julie Williams, and certainly Reese Palmer. All the men that we haven't mentioned, we're not disparaging the men, but the men are out there doing their thing too. Give an ear to country music. And if you're Black folks out there, it's our music, folks. It's our music. Let's get back into it. Revival, Detour. And again, I just want to leave with this. Your words, I just don't want anybody to die feeling like they're forgotten and that they don't matter. I know what that feels like. I think pain is a thread that ties humanity. We deal with death in some form in our lives. And here's somebody who's transcribing and transmitting power of that and the healing power of it and the reviving power of it. So listen to her. Listen to her friends. Certainly listen to Ubuntu People's podcast. And we hope to see you again very, very soon. Reese Palmer, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed this.
I miss the ardor and the labor of love in presenting something like this. First off, having a good conversation with somebody, learning something new, and figuring out a way of presenting the information in an interesting manner. That's what the Ubuntu People's Podcast is about. That's what I enjoy doing. If you have a story to tell, contact me and let's tell it. See y'all next time.